This is the Boundless Pursuit Podcast, a show highlighting the purity of the experience without limitation. Each week, we'll bring anglers as diverse as the fish they chase, whether it be from your backyard or your bucket list. Freshwater, saltwater, conventional gear, or fly, we're bringing stories and perspectives from fishermen from all walks of life, from across the country and globe. In the digital age, authentic communication and networking is critical, and I'd love to hear from you about show suggestions, potential guests, or general feedback. And you can reach me at boundlesspursuitfishing@gmail.com or at my website, www.boundless-pursuit.com. That's where you'll find the entire collection of written articles, podcast episodes, and media. I deeply value the feedback, ratings, reviews, and support of my listeners, and I look forward to hearing from you. I'm your host, David Graham. Now let's get on to today's episode. My guest today is coming in from Saskatchewan, Canada, Chance Presti. Now, Presti is a fisheries biologist, angler, and guide out of Canada. And it was the photos that he had of monster lake trout and Arctic char that drew me to his page. Canada's fishing scene is massive and diverse, and any genuinely passionate angler should really want to experience it, even a southern boy like me. And Presti has taken full advantage, chasing fish like pike, burbot, carp, catfish, and all kinds of other fish. But the eye appeal of the Arctic char is just undeniable, a spectacular species of fish that demands precise timing in its pursuit if you want to have any hope of catching one. And so during this conversation, we talk about getting far from home, fly-in locations, and long hikes to time out a narrow bite window in small, remote stretches of Arctic river systems, all for the chance to maybe cross paths with these beautiful fish. We also talk about Chance's experience guiding and fishing for big lake trout in open water and through the ice. We touch on steelhead fishing around British Columbia and some of Chance's overall experience in fishing and biology, and just how he's been able to tie the two together. This is an awesome conversation with a talented Canadian angler out of Saskatchewan. This is Chance Presti.
Cut in then.
That's the beginning. But anyway, man, I guess first and foremost, I need to say that I appreciate you coming on here. I always appreciate the guys that are like receptive to the invite. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
It's a big thing for me to reach out to people who maybe I've never spoken to or are from places from all over at this point. Having done more than 50 of these episodes, I've had the pleasure of having guys and girls from all walks of life, all age ranges. I've had guys that were like pushing 80 and people as young as 17 on here and everything in between. I know that for me, it's a hell of a lot easier to just stick with one niche and stick with the people that I know and stick with the topics that I know. But I don't know, man. It's like it's more satisfying when these conversations like this, these interactions are organic and real and getting to know somebody. Because I've seen your stuff.
Yeah.
I don't even know how long enough, because the kinds of fish that you catch are very eye popping. Like I see the photo in the background there of the char.
Oh,
like,
the char. Yeah, that would have been 2017 or 18, and a guest of mine caught that one actually. And then some people like taking pictures like small fish. It's like, hey, you hold that one for a picture. And then so that showed up in the mail like in the winter after getting the guy, and it was kind of a nice gift. So
that's awesome. Yeah. Well, it's one of those fish that just like even on a global scale, not just a North American area. It's like it's one of the most gorgeous fish. I mean, my gosh.
They look so crazy in person. Like they look fake, to be honest. Like a lot of pictures I have them, people are like, oh, that's edited. It's like, that's not edited. That's just a raw picture. Like I don't edit anything ever. It's just, it is what it is.
Well, I'll tell you what, since I am now recording, I want to go on record. You know, I know I told you this before I started recording, but I want to go on record and say, I'm from the South.
Yeah.
I don't know jack crap about salmon. I mean, I've done a little bit of trout fishing, but like salmon and trout and char, like sometimes I don't know the difference between one or the other. And that will maybe reflect in this conversation. So I'm taking the position, just so everybody knows who's listening, I'm taking the position of the guy who wants to learn, because that's really is the position that I'm in. You know what I mean? I have all these ambitions of doing travel and doing things and going places and experiencing things. And that's just one of those types of fish. So I guess I'm enough familiar with sort of where you're at, but you know, Canada and the area that you're in is so enormous that it's like, I don't really know where you're at in conjunction with that type of fish or the other. I guess before we get started, I need to establish like where you're from, like where are you located at?
Yeah, so I'm born and raised in Saskatchewan, Canada. I lived here my whole life. Worked kind of all over, mostly in Saskatchewan, but I've done some work in the Northwest Territories as well. That's where I've gone up and done guiding and whatnot, and into Nunavut. So that's the Arctic, generally the Arctic Circle North. But Saskatchewan, if you look at a map of Canada, it's dead center. It has no natural boundaries. It's just a rectangle drawn in the middle of Canada, pretty much.
Yeah.
And if you look at where I live in Saskatchewan, I live in quote unquote northern Saskatchewan. On a map, it's the dead center of the province. If you were to make an X over the corners of the province, about the dead center, just slightly north of that, is a small town called L'Orange, Saskatchewan, on Lac L'Orange, which is about a 500 square mile lake in the center of the province, where the Canadian Shield meets kind of the boreal forest. So I've been here now, it's going on 10 years this winter. I moved up here. I'm a fisheries biologist, and pretty sweet gig working here for the provincial government. And then in my spare time, downtime, or on vacation leave, I'll often end up somewhere in Canada working as a fishing guide. I've done some out in BC this year. Like I said, I haven't been back up to the Arctic since 2019 now.
Okay.
But to fill that gap a bit, I went out and worked on the Skeena system this fall for chasing coho and steelhead mainly. To have a friend out there that's running a lodge now. So that was quite a bit of fun, pretty fun jet boating, different experience. You're, you know, right next to a city, you can stop and you're getting gassing up at the fuel pumps and everything. It's a completely different ball game, but very similar, still pretty remote and whatnot. And in the end, it's you're fishing for some pretty big wild fish too, which is pretty fun. As far as species wise, so back to the salmonids, Saskatchewan has like zero native salmonids except lake trout. And pretty much the northern half of Saskatchewan's, if it's deep enough to have lake trout, if to stratify in summer and have oxygen below the thermocline, it's got lake trout.
Okay.
Some big ones, most places are pretty small. Lac L'Orange had a really good population, but like there's a pavement road to L'Orange and like it collapsed in the 1970s, 80s, 90s, and it's recovering and there's some big fish, but like you don't get 50 pounders here. Commonly get like you'll get 40 up to 45 inch fish that are, you know, up to that 30 pound range, some a little bit bigger. I can't say I've personally tangled with any bigger than that myself, probably with 30 pounds would be max, but they are known to exist. But not that far north, you start getting into like the Reindeer Lakes, the Wollaston Lake, Lake Athabasca. They're all road accessible. If you know what to do and know where to boat on them, you get into some pretty quality fish if you're willing to spend some time. But then northern pike as well, like that's the big fish here, pike and trout in the north, and walleye. Those would be like the top three sport fish in the province.
Yeah, because I know when I look at Saskatchewan on a map, it's like very distinctly different, like night and day. When you look at the maps, it's like the southern part looks like farmland and I don't know, more, I don't want to say developed, but like the footprint of people is there.
Yeah.
Then northern Saskatchewan, like especially as you go progressively north, just looks like no man's land. And I'm like, what is the nature of the fishing like compared? I mean, is it essentially the same thing, just less accessible from north to south?
It is. And because it's less accessible, it's just less touch. Like it's a lot of fly-in fishing camps and whatnot, or, you know, there's a few roads and you can use those to access other pieces of water, like rivers and whatnot, or say like there's, you know, one boat launch on Reindeer Lake you can get onto, and then you can boat 250 kilometers north on Reindeer Lake and still be on the same lake. Like it's a massive body of water.
Yes.
The southern portion of the province, you're right. It's all developed agricultural land for the most part. And then a little ways south of L'Orange would be where the boreal forest starts, probably 120 miles, like 200 kilometers south. And then right where L'Orange is where it really gets transitions from like a sandy type of soil to like exposed bedrock in a lot of places. So it the terrain gets a lot more rugged. Pretty much the forestry industry ends here, because and like the roads end here too, generally. Like from here north, there's one road that takes you north to, you can drive another 600 kilometers on gravel, and then you can launch and like launch a boat on the Fond du Lac River, like Athabasca, or like in winter you could take an ice road to Uranium City. Like that's, and that'd be like the end of it completely. Gosh. But that's 800 kilometers from here. Very, very poor road in most cases. Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's like, it's such a different world than where I'm at. And, you know, I'm in Southwest Florida. I mean, there's no opportunity that I have anywhere remotely near me where I would think like venturing that far into the north. Like when I was looking at it on the maps and I saw where you're from and I'm like, I wonder what kind of fishing this guy does. And I start looking at the northern area. I'm like, just to plan a venture up into that area has got to be like, I mean, granted, you've probably done it enough times that you have a program and a system in place. But I'm you got to account for like days worth of resources. Like I imagine there's not gas stations everywhere. Like if you have a breakdown out in the middle of nowhere, like what is your means of communicating with people? Maybe I'm thinking into it too much, but like,
no, then, like I carry an inReach for that reason. And like, there is some cell towers in the area, like wherever there's a smaller community and there are a few gas stations along the way, but like generally speaking, it's like you get a flat tire, you get out, plug the tire, top the tank with a jerry can and continue on. So I've become very adapted plugging tires.
Where are you sleeping? Just you pitch a tent, or are there some like rustic lodges, or what do they have?
Pretty much exclusively tent when I go up. There are some lodges around, but they're generally either quite rustic or quite expensive. So I tent fairly often on the body of water, like on the lake. Like it's all crown land, so it's government owned land. So you're allowed to camp essentially anywhere you want, which is pretty awesome. There's a few actual campgrounds, like they don't charge money because it's just kind of first come first serve, and really the services are like there'll be like an outhouse. So like I usually don't stay in those unless like we're trying to get back to like the calmer area. If it's like you'll go out and camp at the lake for a few days and then if it gets real windy you come back and like stage next to your vehicle, or if you want to be next to your vehicle or whatnot. But a lot of it's just get there, load gear up in the boat, and go camp on an island somewhere to keep the black bears out, usually.
So. Oh, my. Yeah, well, I can never talk to guys from the, like from where you're at without bringing the bear thing up. I'm sure it probably gets old. Well, we get the same thing here in Florida. You know, people want to ask about the alligators, so it's like probably, I'm sure it's on par. But, you know, the other side of that, too, is like you mentioned, like, fly-in locations. Like, I always wonder, like, how does that, like, is that a casual thing, or is like, are you looking at having to dish out all kinds of money, or do they have like straight up like taxi services that are like planes that will like fly you out there and they're like, we'll be back in 5 days? Like, what those kinds of adventures always interest me, like the ones where you got to literally fly into the location.
Yeah, so that's, you can kind of do both here. Like there's the fly-in fish camps where you fly in and like go into a camp where there'll be a lodge and everything set up, but like a lot of camps also offer like you can fly in, get dropped off on a lake where there's like a boat, a motor, gas, and a cabin to stay in, and you fish. And like, you know, maybe 20, 30 people do it a year, sometimes less. And then you can also just hire, like you said, like a taxi service, like a charter service. Like in L'Orange, there's here, and like a little bit further north on the Churchill River, you can drive up there, get in, load all your gear up and fly into anywhere you want. But like, you need a boat in there. So you'd either be like snowmobiling a boat in winter and cashing it, or taking an inflatable boat, or flying a boat in, which is an added cost. And then if you're doing that, most people like leave the boat. And that's more of a thing to do for hunting moose in the north, to get like really off the beaten path. A lot of the times, a lot of the smaller lakes that you get back to that don't have the infrastructure or like a fish camp or anything on it, the fishing isn't great. Like the northern part of Saskatchewan's pretty, it's like, it's bad rock. So it's all like fairly unproductive systems for the most part. So a lot of the lakes just have like endless small fish and not really any size to them. So it's like the bigger river systems and the bigger lakes and stuff, that's generally where you find like the bigger northern pike, walleye, and trout. So
I gotcha. Well, yeah, I definitely wanted to sort of establish where you're at and what's around you. But then, like, you know, I know that your experience in guiding is interesting to me, like, because you've been around. It's like, you know, I'm like, okay, maybe he guides close to home, but then I looked at some of the places where you've guided at and they're not close to home. So like, I don't, when did that begin? You know what I mean? Like, I guess take me back to the early days of starting out guiding. Like what?
Yeah.
I guess even to the point of when you made the decision to start doing that, and like where you kind of got your start guiding at.
So if I wasn't working as a fisheries biologist, I'd probably be doing that as like a full-time gig, or at least most of the summertime. Simply because I enjoy doing it. It's a great way to drive a boat and I really like taking people fishing and getting people into fish and seeing the reaction when they catch fish and getting to see cool areas that I probably couldn't afford to go to otherwise, like not for that length of time anyway. So I started in 2014 for Plumbers Arctic Lodges. I'd been in contact with them for a year or two ahead of that and had tried to make it work a few times, but I was in graduate school doing a master's degree in fisheries ecology and I just couldn't make it work because like my field season lined up with the same time I'd be up working. So my last year, I finished all my field work, finished up all my lab work, and kind of just had a bit of lull time. And I was like, well, I should probably do it now or I may never do it. So I went up that season as a rookie guide 2014. And then, yeah, it was awesome. I loved it. I was like, I should probably do this full time. That fall, I applied for a job and got a job working as a provincial fisheries biologist. So kind of threw a wrench into the guiding career before it even got going. But it works out really well that I have a fair amount of vacation leave and I can usually take that to work somewhere outside of Saskatchewan. That's why I'd be always outside of Saskatchewan because it'd be a conflict of interest if I was outfitting in Saskatchewan. So that's a no-no. So I've continued to work for Plumbers Lodges. I've gone back up every year to 2019, I think. And then after that, 2020 would have been COVID and I haven't been back up since there. And then last year, a friend of mine that I met out there is running a lodge out in Skeena country in BC, Salmon Steelhead Lodge out there on the Kalem River and Skeena. So he needed a guy to fill in this fall. So I went out there for, I think I was out there for 2 weeks and that was all, I'd fished the area a bunch, but not for salmon. Like I steelhead fished in the area, but I've been doing that for quite a few years, but hadn't ever targeted the salmon that early in the run or the steelhead that far down the system, which was pretty neat, a bit of a learning curve to it. But in the end, it was just driving a jet boat instead of driving a, you know, a propeller driven boat. And once you get the hang of doing that, it'd been a while since I've driven a jet boat, a few years, but got back into that. And yeah, it was a lot of fun to do again. Really reminded me of how much I enjoy doing it and trying to make it work this summer, getting back up to the Arctic. Cause it's, they say once you've been to Great Bear Lake, they say like it's called being bitten by the bear. It's like not a day of your life goes by that you don't think about being back there. It's just a very special place, a massive body of water in the middle of the Arctic. And, pretty much the only species that's everywhere in that lake is lake trout. And it's got the biggest lake trout probably in the world, like definitely the most big lake trout in the world.
And this is at Plumbers Arctic Lodges?
Yeah, or? Plumbers, they operate a few lodges on the lake. They'd have their main lodge and then Trophy Lodge and the Smith Arm, which is about 100 miles straight west of their main lodge. And then they also operate like a self-guided one on the, it's called Arctic Circle Lodge. It's kind of where the Arctic Circle crosses the southern half of the lake. So
okay, yeah, because that's what I was going to ask is like, what are they like, what's the primary fish being targeted there? I mean, so like, let's say you got this Florida boy like me who says I want to go to Plumbers Lodge. What is the experience like there? You know what I mean? Like, what is day-to-day, you know, the day-to-day experience at the lodge like, the fishing, the nature of the fishing, you know, what is a day start and end with?
So it depends what you want to fish for too, and then each lodge has its own slightly different fishing. I've never guided Arctic Circle. I've been there, but I've never fished or guided at it, just setting up camp 1 year. Oh, okay. And so I've spent most of my time on Great Bear guiding on the Smith Arm at Trophy Lodge. So that is all boat access, no plane to do like flyouts to other locations. So you're boating to everywhere you fish, but you can catch big fish like in the first few weeks of season. Like I've guided a 39 pounder like 400 yards off the field dock. Like guys got in the boat on shore, like get let lines out there. Like, what do you mean? I was like, she's pretty windy out today. Like we're not going far. So, yeah. Boom, big fish. But that's also Great Bear Lake. Like you never know. All the lodges are that way where they're all in excellent locations where you can catch massive fish right in front of the lodge or like even offshore at the lodge. I've seen guys catch pretty big lake trout before. And yeah. It's lake trout fishing. Like there's northern pike as well in some of the rivers there, but it's not a pike fishery. It's a little too far north for them. They still get to be some like fairly long fish. Like you'll catch fish in the 40 to 45 inch range, and there are bigger ones, but you're not there for pike. Like if you want pike, you go somewhere further south where the pike get bigger and more numerous. It's lake trout and Great Bear Lake. There's also the biggest Arctic grayling in the world, but a lot of people don't actually fish for them that much. Everybody usually go once or twice just to catch grayling and like, let's go a 20 inch grayling. It's like, that's a huge grayling anywhere else in the world, but that's pretty much your average fish there. You'll get them up to like 22, 23 inches, the odd one, maybe a bit bigger. But people are there for lake trout. It's Great Bear Lake. It's lake trout is the number one species in the lake. It's the only fish that occurs everywhere in that lake. And yeah, it's, they've got like a few different morph forms of them, not quite subspecies, but they'll be, they'd be on their way to subspeciating if they'd had more time since the last glaciation. So they'll have like the little small kind of surface feeders and bottom feeders. Mm-hmm. And those are actually often called like a butterfly or a redfin, like really big fins just due to their, they get really, really old and they're still like 30 inches long. Some of them live as long as like 70 years. And then you'll have like the big cannibalistic or predatory ones that like eat those ones as well as other fish species. And like those are like the silvers or the grays. And like, that's what people are usually there for, is to catch those, you know, giant fish that are fairly often 4 feet long and 40 to 50 pounds. The odd 50 plus gets caught a year. And like every year or two, there's a 60 plus caught as well. Sometimes, yeah, when you're in the right place at the right time, it's like you spend the whole summer like, or season looking for these fish. And then like, you'll hit like one or two magical days where you just, the stars align and you get on like the big fish, cause they're all together usually, or they're all kind of grouped up like big fish usually.
I mean, I've seen the photos of them where there's like a fish that looks like it's a third of their length hanging out of their throat.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So, like I've had a 14 pound lake trout on the line. well, I guessed at it, and like a 25 pounder was trying to eat it. That's like, okay, come on. Like it's literally over half your length. But like,
so then my next question is like, well, what are you using to catch them? Like, what is the approach? Like, what are the tactics? I don't know anything about these fish. Are you like trolling deep? Are you, I mean, what kind of gear? And then the other thing is like the size of the bodies of water that they're in. Like, what is even the search pattern for finding them?
Yeah.
Are you using like some kind of crazy advanced sonar to figure out where they're at?
The big one in spring is water temperature. Like, and by spring, I mean July, because the ice comes off that lake at the end of June.
Yeah.
Most years, like I've been there a few times first week of July and there's still icebergs floating around, water temperatures right freezing cold, slushy ice in places. And so you're looking for the warmer water in spring, and it's shallow water, sandy flats where there's a river maybe coming in and it warms up quicker. So like you get that 50 degree water, and like the lake trout are going to find that water because the food's there, and they're going to come in and feed heavier than they are in the 35 degree water out in the middle where it's cold. And then as the season progresses, you end up fishing deeper and deeper. But in Saskatchewan, when you fish for lake trout, in a lot of cases, like they'll be below the thermocline, you know, 60, 80, 100 feet of water down fairly deep. Our lakes stratify hard. Great Bear Lake's far enough north and it's a big enough body of water that it is starting to stratify some years, but like in local regions, it doesn't truly stratify. It'll still turn over throughout the season. So sure, some shallow areas will get too warm for lake trout by the end of season, but like you're fishing deep water, like 35 feet, like not like you're fishing in Saskatchewan or further south where they're in 100 feet of water. So when it gets like that, sometimes you'll like clip inline weights on, but for the most part, it's just flat landing lures, just trolling straight out of the back of the boat.
Okay.
You can catch some casting and everything too. It's just when you're hunting for the really big fish, it's all about how much time you have your lure in the water. Like in an 8 hour day of fishing, if you're hog trolling, like you might have 2-3 grabs like in a boat for two guys. On a good day, sure, you might have 8 or 10, but like if you're casting all day, like that's tedious. And like your hook's probably not in the water when a fish comes by, and lake trout are notorious for following. So like you'll have a big fish follow. Sometimes, you know, guys will reel in. It's like, oh, there's a fish following. Let back out. Troll for like 8 to 10, maybe 15 minutes, do some circles trying to get that fish to bite. It's like, okay, reel up. It's like, that's still there. Like, it's just, you've gone half a mile and that same fish or two is following still. And you got to trigger that bite on them. But you have to find fish. Temperature is a big one. When I first started, I was like, oh, it's all temperature. And yeah, as you get to older and learn more and more, you can catch fish in really warm water where they shouldn't be sometimes, or in cold water where they shouldn't even be feeding. But that's kind of the exception to the rule. For the most part, it's still related to temperature. And for lake trout, 50 degrees Fahrenheit is like a magical number. If all the water is 50, maybe, you know, 55. If all the water is 60, maybe 50 again. If all the water is 65 or warmer, you're looking for a little bit colder water. But also if all the water is 35 degrees, like, and then you find 40, it's a little bit warmer. So like, it's all relative as well. Like there's no magic temperature. And then the other big thing is where the wind was blowing, like maybe not where the wind's currently blowing, but if there was a big wind for a day or two and you got all the bait pushed up into like a certain area, there's a big point that sticks out and kind of filters a current around it and stacks bait up. If you get that to align with the right temperatures, that's generally when you get on like onto bigger fish, or numbers of bigger fish.
Okay. Yeah. So you're almost like forecasting the bites, like the weather. That's interesting.
You try to anyway.
Yeah. You want to. Well,
yeah.
You might be more accurate than the local meteorologists.
Yeah.
So, but Like the nature of the work though is interesting to me, and even getting to position. So like when you did you have to like apply for the job? Did you know a guy there? I mean, how do you prove that you've like got the acumen to be able to take people out? Is there a like a captain's course you had to take and a process of becoming certified to take people out? You know, I mean, they don't want to just put any old guy that's some young ambitious worker out to, you know, take clients out, I would think.
Yes and no. Like generally speaking, like I had a friend that had worked there for quite a few years who's trying to get me to come up, and I'll say since I've been out of high school, I've never had a job, a full-time job like for a summer or anything that didn't involve just driving a boat for the most part. Like I've been a glorified boat driver my entire life.
Yeah.
It's just as a guide, that's what you do. As a fisheries biologist, that's what I did. As a fisheries tech, that's what I did. As a lab tech for a university lab doing water sampling, like I drove the boat and maintained the equipment. So I've just always kind of been a boat driver. Very comfortable driving a boat, usually more comfortable than driving anything else. That's kind of just what it falls back to every time. Feel pretty free doing it. So essentially, I just was a boat driver and knew some people, and I knew that they were looking for guides, and applied at the right time. And then you go up and do training there. You do need to have, like in Canada, it's called a pleasure craft operator card, which is just a very minimal course to take just to cover some bases legally that you can drive a boat. There's nothing to do with a boat. It's all more buoys and whatnot than anything else. So you do need that. And then obviously like first aid and whatnot. I also have like a slightly more advanced license. Like it's called small vessel operator proficiency, which does have like a practical component to it. So I can drive larger boats out, which are further from shore as well. But you don't need it a lot of places because you only need it if you're like more than one nautical mile offshore. So if you're not on a huge lake, you don't really need it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so had that all. And then essentially I just applied for it, got up there, did the, as a rookie guide, you just kind of do a quote unquote guide training, which is some guide training and then a lot of hard physical labor to see if you break easy. if you, yeah.
What does that entail? Just carrying heavy stuff? Washing the boat, like what is that?
Yeah, it depends what happens. Funny story, my first time up there, like everybody was out of getting all the like flyouts and other camps set up, and like so there's very skeleton crew on site at the main lodge plumbers, and the septic line blew up, so it involved snaking,
the rookie like,
snaking a mile of septic line through like the most black fly infested forest I've ever been in. So I think I ended up with like 150 to 200 black fly bites on my neck, and had a horrible allergic reaction. So after that, they're just like, yeah, you worked hard, you're good.
Jeez.
So, and then you do like some on the water training, just obviously to make sure you're not lying about your credentials and like you actually know how to drive a boat. And then they usually, for the first few weeks, you get paired up with like an experienced guide in a group. So it'll be like a group of four people come up or whatever, and they'll put you together like that. And then once you've learned the lake a fair bit and what to do, you'll maybe end up like going on your own a bit. I think my actual first week I had just like a solo, husband and wife couple. But like there's a few of those in the lodge. So we kind of, me and a couple other guys kind of, you know, make plans to go fish together for the day or make shore lunch together. So you're always kind of working together. Now you carry like an inReach with you too, so you can message each other and whatnot if there's any emergency. At the time, we all had like radios that you could contact each other if you were within like probably 1 to 2 miles of range. So fairly often there'd be somebody else there, and with everybody having that, like it worked pretty good. The inReaches are definitely better. They're a little more lag time. Like you send a message and it comes back, but yeah, it's incredible that you can send those anywhere you want in the world pretty much. That's the big thing there. And the fishing's like relatively easy, all things said, like for the Arctic, because it's fairly untouched. So going out and catching fish is pretty easy. And like, if you have people that just want to catch fish, it's easy to do. If you have people that want to catch lots of big fish, it gets harder because just like anything, there's not as many big fish. And even though you're maybe in the best place in the world for big lake trout, even when there's a lot of them, there's still not that many of them. You're still hunting for these things. So it ends up being almost more like hunting than anything, which I'm also a fairly big hunter. So I really enjoy that aspect of it. That trophy fish is that way. It's just kind of, you're looking for that, like an individual fish. obviously once you find it, you always want a bigger one or more big ones or how it goes, but get the hooks back out, boys. Like they're in, and it is what it is, but it's no different from what I do now, like fishing in Saskatchewan. If I'm going out with friends or whatnot, it's obviously drive to lakes and smaller scale, take your own boat and everything. But I fish very much the same way, where you're hunting for that fish, where you might come back after a week of fishing and talk to some guys that you know, on shore and be like, how's fishing? Be like, well, if we got like, you know, a couple big fish, a 30 pounder or something, or, you know, maybe a 35 or 40 and, or some 20s or, and like, well, how many do you guys catch? It's like, yeah, we got seven fish. It's like, yeah, you were home for a week. It's like, we got like 100 a day. It's like, yeah, but none of them were over 10 pounds. Like, we actively tried not to catch those fish because it's just a different, it's a big fish and you're looking for different fish.
Yeah. How do you determine, well, is there like a different approach for the big fish compared to the smaller one? I mean, is this like a solitary kind of, I don't know anything about lake trout. It's an interesting fish. And I mean, I've love to see the photos of them, but like, is it generally, if you catch one, you can expect, okay, we're near where they're at, or is it like, that doesn't mean anything, that's just where that fish is at? Are they like a lone wolf type of species, or are they kind of like loosely congregated? Like, if you find one, are you finding others?
Loosely congregated is probably the perfect way you could put that, because like, the small fish will school off like crazy where there's bait.
Yeah,
so when the food's there, they're all there. But like, the big ones hunt like, it's like, I call it more of like a pack or in pairs than in like a school of them. But you will see schools of fish. This summer I got lucky and got onto like a school of big fish with a friend of mine. And so pretty much every time you bring up like a 20 plus pound lake trout, there'd be one or two more with it. So the other guy's flipping hooks off the bat, bondies or whatnot.
I was
fairly upset with myself. I didn't have a fly rod in the boat because we caught like four fish all day. It was a terrible day of fishing. We'd gone out on a really big body of water and we fished all day, didn't see a boat. And I was like, it's probably not a great sign because it's probably not in the right place. Like, we just kind of played a gamble and went to an area of the lake I never fished. And the water was too cold. We got there, and even though it was like kind of late June, early July, somewhere around there, it just, the water temps weren't right. It was, everything was probably, we're a week or two early for that area. So we ended up coming back and just having a great evening of fishing. Probably the best evening of lake trout fishing I've personally got to experience. First fish of like, I think at 11 p.m. I got a 41 pounder, which is like the first 40 I've boated not on Great Bear Lake. So I was pretty excited about that.
Yeah.
And like, two other fish chased it up, and I was like, buddy got in the net. I was like, grab the rod and cast. And like, three casts in a row, he hooked up before he finally got one pegged. And then I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to net this 25 pound lake trout with a 40 pounder in the net. And yeah, it got pretty interesting. And then we're just kind of sitting there for a minute. I was like, well, we better let our hooks out again. Like, there was multiple more of them. And it was, yeah, we just kind of looked for that same school of fish for the next, well, we fished through the night and fished till I think 8 a.m. And then the wind picked up and a storm blew in, and right through the dark, and got light out again, and ended up with a few more. Like, I think big fish was that first, the 41 pounder, the first fish with the big fish.
What does this boat look like?
32.
Has this boat got a cabin? Like, can you go in and chill out for a while, or is this just like you're out in the elements?
This is a 16-foot tinner. It's like a 1980s Naden of mine. I bought it and like put it floor in it. I actually built it for like fly fishing for pike. But it works great for two guys for lake trout fishing, for pike or lake trout. Like, it works quite effective for it. But like, just a 30-horse tiller on the back, and that's what I'm driving around with. And like, just pretty limited space. Like, the net takes up a lot of real estate. It's a big net, but everyone always says like, that's the biggest net I've ever seen. But yeah, then when you have a 40-pound fish in it and you got to go scoop a 25-pounder, it's like, that's what that net's for.
Jeez.
So, but the reason for having a small boat here, you can get bigger boats to these lakes and launch them, but bigger boats are A, a lot more money, and B, it's a lot harder to tow them long distances like that. It's a pretty poor road in northern Saskatchewan to get anywhere. So you might be blowing up tires in the trailer, or like, that trip on the way back, I like looked at the leaf springs were like wearing out where they rub on the trailer. So like, well, through a chain and a chain tensioner on the two leaf springs to hold the two tires so that they're together. And like, I guess I'm driving home like that slower than usual, but it's just, the bigger the equipment, the more expensive the equipment, the more damage you do to it, and the slower you got to go. So I like using smaller boats like that. And then you can, for pike fly fishing in particular, you can get into like the really shallow bays where they are in spring and not have to worry about that clearance you need with like a bigger boat motor too. So
yeah,
it's kind of a dual purpose boat for that. Guiding the Arctic, we'll use like 18-foot Lunds. To be honest, like, the weather's usually pretty good at Great Bear Lake in July. Like, it's cold water, even if it is a bit of wind. Like, towards the end of July into August, you'll get into bigger winds and you might be limited as to where you can go. But with an 18-foot boat and a 40 horse on it, like, you can go a long ways, and like, you don't need to go that far. Usually, like, within a half hour to hour boat ride, you're on the best fishing in the area usually. And if it's too windy for an 18-footer, it's probably too windy for anything, because the wind picks up there and there's 100 miles of fetch. You're looking at 6 to 8 foot waves, so like, you're not going out with any kind of fishing then, so you're just sticking around closer in the sheltered areas.
And I don't know where your experience in guiding and in fishing lies like chronologically. But I think about that style of fishing in seeing your photos, but then the nature, we're sort of segueing here because the nature of the fishing that you've done, I guess, where is it, the Tree River area?
So that's another outpost of Plumbers. Like they have they have the only outpost on it. So it's a flyout they operate from the main lodge, or you can book like a specific trip there, but the specific trip is like 1 week a year and it's like coveted. And like, I don't know how long it's booked for, but I think after COVID it was booked up for like 7 or 8 years straight. And it's such a short window of when that season can actually work, of when those fish are in the river and before there's like miserable weather, because you're far enough north there that like, I've been there the end of August and you're getting snowed on, it's below zero. And like, grizzly bears in the area are kind of getting hungry because winter's coming. It's just like, everything's brown. It's just, it goes from full summer to full on fall there in like a week. So, and you're losing 20 to 30 minutes of daylight a day. It's crazy how quick everything changes up in the Arctic. It's just different environment with a short system. So obviously I went up there, I worked 2 years. I went up and did like the close out of season at the Tree River. So went up kind of early August for, I think 1 year is about 15, 16 days I was there, and the other year is about 18. So then we were there for the whole time living in the guide cabin, and then guests were coming and going. And then it ends with like the last week of season for people come for like the char exclusive or the Tree River exclusive, it's called, where it's everybody's there for about a week. And then they fly you back. You actually come back to Great Bear now. We used to fly out to Kugluktuk, but like, everybody's, both years I was there, like every connection flight was missed because like couldn't get the float plane out or couldn't land the float plane at Cug because it's like not a whiteout storm, but it's like 0 degrees out and like just overcast for days on end and windy. So they actually fly back to Bear because then it's easier to land because they have an airstrip there and they can fly from there back to Yellowknife and get out. So they've done it that way, and it adds a day onto the trip. And like, you might be able to fish on Bear if the winds aren't too big that time of year, but a lot of time by the end of August, she's a pretty stormy system up there. The waters are the warmest they're going to be all year, and that makes some big winds and big waves on the lake. So, But yeah, so the Tree River, if you get up there that time of year, it's actually a pretty diverse fishery, because it's, you have like the big colored up fish in the river. And being that it's the Arctic Ocean, those fish can't overwinter in salt water because they'll freeze to death because they don't have antifreeze in their blood and the water temps go below zero because it's salt water. So they all have to come back and spend the winters in like an estuary or in one of the freshwater rivers, not necessarily the ones they spawn in. So the Tree River is one of the southernmost rivers in the Arctic Ocean, the Coronation Gulf. It flows into a little kind of estuary called Port Epsworth. And that's just like a shallower, more productive area. So it's got like tons of bait fish. You'll be out there and they'll be like, I've seen like bait balls of like capelin and other fish species just pushed up there with like the seals, and well, they come up to spawn and then the seals push them all up and the char just go nuts. And so you can get onto like big silver chrome char in the ocean. You can get into like the ones coming back to freshwater for the fall, like to overwinter in it. Big fish that have been feeding all summer out in the ocean, like coming back to a little system where they're neck down and like have to overwinter there. And then you do have the ones that are running up to spawn, and the Tree River population is unique. We were talking about this a bit earlier, where they're not truly Arctic char, they're not truly Dolly Varden, they're Tree River char is what I call them. They're one of a kind, and there's a few other rivers that they look very similar and have similar genetics, but the limited genetic studies I've seen on it have all kind of said they're like hybrids of northern Dolly Varden crossed with char in the area. And then you end up having like a hybrid complex of where these fish, some of them will be almost pure char and some of them will be up to like 3/4 Dolly Varden. And you get with hybrid fish, you often get like hybrid vigor where they end up better than either parent species would be in the same environment, grow quicker, and fairly often they're sterile. But in the case of the genus Selvolanus, which char, Dolly Varden, lake trout, brook trout, bull trout, they're all in the same genus. They're all fairly closely related, and it's kind of like a species complex where where the line of what a species is blurs somewhat with like geography and overlaps. Like a lot of them can interbreed and can interbreed to produce somewhat fertile offspring. Or in the case of like Dolly Varden and Arctic char, they produce almost perfectly fertile offspring as far as I know.
That was like one of the main things I'd written here. I know I'd mentioned this before we started recording, but I'd had Andrew Bunker on here a long time ago. I don't think it was like episode 4 maybe. And you know, he mentioned, I think there's been some crossover and in even areas that y'all fished for Arctic char, but it's like, it's a species that I have so much interest in, but then I've run across these photos since then and I'm like, oh man, that's one of those Arctic char. And then I click on it and it says Dolly Varden. I'm like, what? Like, what's the difference? So like, I had written that down, like, and maybe the answer is just not clear, but like, that was kind of a specific thing I was wondering is there a difference between, like, you know, how can you tell the two apart, a Dolly Varden and a Arctic char? Is it, or is it just more of a geographic difference? Maybe apples to oranges here, but it's like, you know, our steelhead and then rainbow trout, which is just like, well, one of them is can travel to the ocean, the other one's landlocked. I don't know. It's like, what's the real, is there really like a genetically different, like, is there like a genetic difference between the two?
Yeah, so that's actually the best and easiest way to tell them apart, is to like take a fin clip, sample it for DNA, and then figure out which one it lines up with more, which is not how people in fisheries like doing things. Morphologically, they are different as well, but they have characteristics that overlap with each other. And by no means am I a specialist in char salmon, but definitely like the genus Selvolanus is a passion of mine. Like, I work with lake trout all the time. That's the only native one we have to Saskatchewan. But I love fishing for all of them and like the hybrids of them and everything. And like, I just love seeing the variation from place to place. So, like, I'll catch fish in the Skeena drainage in BC that look identical to the fish in the Tree River. And it's just like, so that's a Dolly Varden, or a Dolly Varden possibly crossed with a bull trout or some variation there in that drainage. And the ones in the Tree River are supposed to be Arctic char on paper, but they're called Arctic char based on solely where they were. There was no known populations of Dolly Varden within, I don't know the distance, if it's 500 miles or 1,000 miles or anything to the west. So like in Alaska, you've got populations of northern Dolly Varden. Those giant northern Dolly Varden that, you know, they get 20 pounds. They look just like the ones from the Tree River, like you were saying. And then you have a bunch of Arctic char populations as well in that area. And then as you travel further to the east, you get only Arctic char. But for some reason, like the Copper Mine River by Kugluktuk to about the Tree River, which is, it's about an hour flight from there. I don't know if it's how many miles it'd be, probably 120, 140 miles straight east. That area has a few rivers that have like the quote unquote hybrids. And I've seen very limited data on them, but I've seen them in person and I've, you know, taken a dichotomous key along to like, what are these things? And like, they're definitely halfway between the two. And from the DNA sampling I've seen on them, it's a variability of like, they could be, some of the fish are pure char. Like, there are pure char in the system. They're not necessarily the ones spawning there. They're maybe just overwintering in that area. And then there's fish that are up to like 75% Dolly Varden. And like those ones that look like Dolly Varden, they're part Dolly Varden. And then like a few times, and I'd mentioned this earlier, like I've seen fish or like another guy will catch, guest catches a fish and they're like, what is that? They're like, I don't know. And then so they'll bring it back. And like being somebody that has a background in fisheries, I'll usually be like the people that get asked those questions, like, hey, we got something weird today. Like, what is this thing? And like, I try to know a little bit about it. All species of salmon and whatnot, but like, it's not I'm not educated in it formally to any major degree, but fairly often you'll get like a hybrid of a lake trout crossed with a char, which is probably more of a lake trout crossed with a char that was crossed with a Dolly Varden. So like, every fish there that looks different is unique. Like, it's a one of a kind fishery because you're catching these weird looking fish, and like, you can catch 2 15-pound male Arctic char from the exact same run one after another, and they don't look like the same species because they're probably not. They're probably both, like, one might be, you know, 10% Dolly Varden, the other might be 75% Dolly Varden. So like,
that's weird.
It's a species complex, and some of it is geographical, but they do exist in other places in the same systems and don't hybridize. So the Tree River is unique in that it's very short. There's maybe 3 to 5 miles of spawning habitat.
That's what I was gonna bring up. Yeah, that was like a very specific limited thing. When I saw that you'd written about the Tree River, I looked at what it looked like on the maps, and it always throws me off because I'm used to rivers that flow south, and up there it's like flowing north. But then I realized there's like this giant waterfall, like 3 miles from the coast. I'm like, so how much of the river are they really even able to occupy? Like, that's a tiny section of river.
It's an impassable set of falls that we refer to as third falls because it's the third set, and in low water, the second set's impassable to to most of the char as well. In high water, they will make it over. There's some spawning habitat above it. Really nice stuff, actually. But okay, there's only like 3 miles of spawning habitat. And of that, it's like largely class 4 and 5 rapids. So like there's very small sections of spawning habitat, which is probably why the fish there get so big, because like it's often those males that are huge and they're holding those spawning territories. Like the best, biggest male gets the best spawning habitat, and the biggest females are going to come there to mate because it's the best gravel with upwelling.
Yeah.
Very limited spawning habitat, which is probably why they kind of hybridize as well. As well, there's like 2 sets of falls that are, one's maybe 6 to 7 feet tall, and the other one's probably 8 to 10 feet tall, depending on the height of the water coming over it, like the flows. And char will make it over those, but like a fairly defining characteristic of Arctic char in most populations is that they can't jump over waterfalls, which is kind of ironic that
on this
tree they do. Yeah. So maybe that has something to do with it. I'd love to see it studied more. Like, I wish I would have known more about this when I was, you know, in undergrad and looking at potential projects to do for a master's or PhD at the time. But I, by the time I learned about this, I was already finishing up my master's and I was not looking to start another research project and track down funding for something like this that people don't honestly care that much about. Like, it's neat. It's a really cool fish in a real cool area and it's kind of one of a kind.
I think it's incredibly neat. And even peering over your shoulder at that fish you have in the background, granted, most people are listening to this. They can Google what an Arctic char looks like. But, you know, the more I'm learning about these fish, especially the ones in that stretch, it's like you've got this species of fish that is only in there, at least if you want to get one of the real beautiful colored ones. I'm assuming you've got a tiny little narrow window of time. You've also got a tiny little narrow window of river. I can't imagine getting there is that easy. Then I would think all the other diehard anglers that are aware of these circumstances, what do they have, like a lottery system just to get in there? Like, I would think that those fish, are they just getting pounded and pressured hard for like a week? I mean, so
the season will run for July and August, but like if the water's too high in July or cold, like it's very tough fishing because there's like the fish can spread out into all kind of like the low backwater floods and stuff too. And like some of the fish won't even be in the river because they're in the ocean feeding, but those colored up fish are the ones that are good to stay and spawn. And like they usually start spawning probably like by the end of August. I've seen some males that were probably almost ready to go or holding territories, but generally speaking, I'd think their spawn is like just into the first bit of September, end of August, beginning of September. Anecdotally, from having been there almost up to that time, that's kind of when you're starting to see fish like move into the spawning habitat. But to get a colored up one, like they're pretty chrome until like the end of July. So like to get a colored up fish like that, you're looking at like a 2 to 3 week window in August. And it's booked up for years. Like it'll be, you can do it as a day trip from the main lodge of Great Bear Lake where they fly out, or like a 2 day trip sometimes. And then as part of like, they have a package called Fly Fishing Week where it comes with like a 2 day trip to the Tree River, pending that the weather's like you can even land there. And then, cause you're landing in a float plane on the river. There's obviously no roads to Great Bear Lake or the Tree River, like you're literally the middle of nowhere. So like it's a two hour float plane ride in a turbo otter from Great Bear Lake to there if the weather's good. And so you land in the river, guides come down, pick you up because you can't land right at the camp. There's an airstrip there that they used to run, but they're just running smaller like the otters now, so that you don't need the airstrip. You can land on the river, it's a lot easier. Boat you up to the lodge is just like a tent camp there. The lodge itself is a hard walled building, and then the rest of them are like canvas, like I don't know if they'd be plasticized canvas like wall tents, but like like permanent buildings. Like they're probably, I don't know how old they'd be now, but like when I was up there, they were all still in really good shape. And like the guide cabin was obviously the one that maybe had a couple leaks in the roof and whatnot, but other than that, it's pretty rustic camp because you're in the middle of nowhere. And you got like a 2 week season where they bring people in to fish specifically there, and it's usually limited to like, depending on the year, 8 to 12 anglers, because there's very limited habitat to fish. So you can go up the left side, which is actually river right, or the right side, which is river left. It's just called backwards there because that's tradition. So you can go river left or river right up river, or you can go down river from camp. And down river is more fishing from a boat, or there's like a few runs you can, you know, pull up on shore and spay cast offshore or cast offshore and catch fish as they're coming in from the ocean. More chrome fish down low, and then once you go up, it's kind of into the colored fish. But there's not a ton of water to fish. Some years the runs aren't as high as they are other years, and like there aren't a ton of fish there. Some years there are a ton of fish and it's just like overflowing with fish and you can see fish, but they're also quite spooky. And like, it's an interesting fishery because it is like you're in the middle of nowhere, but they're fairly pressured, but they're pressured by the same people, like the same guides over and over. So like,
yeah,
it's kind of neat. Sometimes you go there and like, just like walk past the spot every day. And then like you stop and look and there's a fish there one day and you're like, okay. So next day you come there and you sneak up there and it's like, well, there's like 8 or 10 char sitting behind this rock that nobody's fished all season. Cause you just walk past it. And it's like, boom, you hammer 3 in a row and like come back and like, you're a hero. It's like, oh, where'd you get them? It's like, don't, it doesn't even have a name. It's just like the water was low enough. We could cross this channel and get to this other low spot. So there's a lot of the river you can't fish simply because it's like, again, like class 4 and 5 rapids. So depending on the water levels, it changes where the fish sit and where you can fish. So there's always those fish that are kind of out in those sections in the middle that you can't really get to at all. So there are like little quote unquote sanctuaries for them all over the place. But you'll catch fish in a hole. And like sometimes, you know, 2 or 3 days later, you'll hook a fish in another side of the river. And it's like, yeah, that's the same one we caught on the other side. Like he migrated up like a kilometer since then. Yeah. Kind of neat. I've only seen that once or twice, but it is kind of cool to see that like that fish moved that much. And then some days you'll come to a hole and it's just loaded with fish. And then the conditions change or whatever. And like 2-3 days later, there's not a fish in that pool. Like they moved somewhere else in the river because it's fairly close. Like the pools aren't that far apart because, again, there's not that much water. But fairly often they'll be to the other side of the river that you're not on. So,
yeah,
it is what it is.
That's awesome. Well, just getting to the point where you're even able to hold a fish like that in your hands for the photo. I know that a lot goes into it. I mean, so you're flying into the area, then you're taking a boat for some amount of the trip, but like getting to that 3-mile stretch, is it like, I mean, are you having a hike or are there like nice little roads that lead right up to it? Like just getting in front of the fish, like it sounds like a journey in and of itself. Is this involving a lengthy walk and a hike?
So the camp is set up right on the bottom of like where the rapids are in the river, where so you can boat all the way up to the camp. There's a few shallow sections, but like even in low water, if you watch for the rocks and put it on shallow drive or whatnot, you can drive up. Above that, there's one more spot you can boat up and kind of cut across the river to get to river. It'd be river left, but called the right side there. And you walk up that side, and that's as far as you can boat, because above that, she's just straight rapids, and you can walk all the way up to Third Falls that way. Be about I can't put time on the walk because like I've done it in like 20 minutes guide time when somebody gets spooled and like I'm headed back to camp to get another fly line because guy just got spooled and you got to make time. But I've also done it in like 3 or 4 hours where you're walking with older guests that maybe have some trouble walking. It's a pretty worn trail because it's used not daily, but like quite a bit for the season. The left side too is maybe a little bit more rugged trail. But again, like you're just from camp, you get up in the morning and you're going upstream, you start hiking, and depending which side you go on, you either drive a boat across to ferry to the other side, or you just keep hiking straight up and hit the pools on the way, and then fish what you want to fish and see where the fish are, hit the pools on the way back down. And generally speaking, you kind of just make a plan with the other guides as to who's going to hit what areas each day. And if guests are there for a few days, you want to, guys will definitely have their favorite pool, but like you kind of want people to see the whole river too, like from both sides, because it's just every hole every run is such a different place to fish, even depending on water levels. So you're gambling a bit on like what water clarity is going to be like too, because it does change because there's glacial till banks upstream of you. So as you move upstream, above Third Falls, it's like a pretty flat river with not much gradient. Below that, there's a bit of a flat section, and then like Second Falls, and then it's just pure gradient to camp where like I said about getting spooled, if a fish gets out in the current, like it's chasing time across broken rocks. We call it the Char Olympics because like you'd just be running full speed across like crazy rocks, and you just see a guide running and you're just watching. It's like, I've never seen one guide wipe out, but like, oh, if you did, like it'd be horrendous because like you either broken limbs or like scratched up face or something, because it's pretty rugged terrain. Cleats on boots go a long way there, aluminum cleats. You feel like Spider-Man running around with them on, but it's an interesting place for doing that. You're walking from camp or you're boating down. Like, and the thing is, like from camp to the ocean is only like 6 or 7 miles as well. So there's very little fresh water in the system that is open to anadromous fish coming from the ocean. And there's also lake trout in the river. They're like the trash fish there, which is kind of ironic, but you can catch like pretty nice lakers on dry flies. Like there's caddis patches where you'll catch like resident char and lakers and dry flies. And then there are what were kind of unknown to science until like the early 2000s, semi-anadromous lake trout as well, that'll go to the estuary and feed.
Oh, interesting.
I've even seen some in the estuary, and like, they're usually pretty chrome. Some of them are like, there are like 40-inch plus fish in there. Every few years, somebody gets like a 35 to 40 pounder. while fishing for char, and it's just like a rank big lake trout that's like, where did you even come from in this little river system? But just a very, very productive system that it flows into. It's like, there's all sorts of fish. You'll get like, there's a few different runs of sea run lake trout. Sorry, not lake trout, sea run whitefish as well. Like there's, I believe there'd be broad whitefish, round whitefish, and probably lake whitefish. And then like Arctic cisco, you'll catch like some other like down by the ocean, like flounder and sculpin and like cod species. But yeah, there's just a ton of fish coming in because there's a ton of food there is what it is. And so it's very productive. All these fish come in like, so you might be fishing an area one day and there's like very few fish at the run. And then you come there the next day, and it's like, it's just chocked full of fresh fish that just ran up from the, like got maybe a bump of rain or something. And like the fish just decided to run that night. And it's like, oh, there's like some chrome char showed up. And like, and we came to one run one time. We looked at that, looked at there's like, there's like hundreds of fish in this pool. I was like, guy casts in there and like hooks like a 2 pound lake trout and like a 25 pounder just crushes it and tears it off his line, like right at my feet. And
I'm
just like,
wow.
Oh, there's like four more of those. And like the guy casts again, like ends up hooking. We didn't even catch a char that day. I think we ended up catching like four or five of those great big lake trout. None of them were quite that big. I think around 20 pounds is the biggest, but those would probably be like those semi-anadromous lake trout that had spent a little bit of time in that brackish or salt water feeding out there to get to be that size.
That's interesting. It's funny how that trash fish term like moves around geographically. And it's like, I always get a laugh out of that. But the nature of the fishing, I guess, is you know, I want to just dive into that because, you know, I know sometimes when, you know, salmon or trout are on a migratory run, like their feeding patterns are suspect, you know, almost to the point of sometimes it's like, are they actually eating? So then like something like a char, which is, again, I can't say this enough, totally foreign to me, but like,
Yeah,
I know you're doing predominantly fly fishing. So, like, what are you throwing? Like, streamers, traditional salmon flies, dry flies, all of the above. I mean, like, what's the approach to catching one of them? How are you drawing the bite? And is it like are you just assuming where they're going to be? Or is it like, if we don't like visibly see these fish, we're not casting?
A little bit of all of that. Like, some days it's crystal clear water. If you get like a big wind or a rain, like it'll stir up kind of like the glacial till above you and you get like milkier water, which I always prefer the milkier water to fish because you can sneak right up on the fish then because like they are fairly spooky. Yeah. But on some of those days where it's like that murkier water, throwing big streamers at them is probably my favorite thing to do on like a single hand rod. Like there are a few good spey fishing runs early in the season. It's really good like spey fishing with casting and swinging for fish sitting in runs. Towards the end of the season, lower water, fish are more pooled up, getting closer to like the spawning areas and spawning time of year and like a little bit of lockjaw, like you said, they're not really feeding in that fresh water. They're just kind of sitting there waiting. They will still feed. There's just like not a ton of food for them to be feeding on. But oftentimes, like a big streamer, I'll get like an aggressive attack out of a fish, especially if it looks like something they're used to eating. I just tied some like long kind of guys love like zonker type flies there, Dalai Lamas, like rabbit, anything like that. Towards late season, I found like some thinner flies, like a little bit sparser patterns. Sometimes like if you can't get a bite from fish, like nymphing works really good. If you have guys that want to indicator fish, like just dead drift something down or egg sucking leech is like, just like anything else, any salmon, it'll probably eat that if it drifts in front of its face. My favorite is, I guess, sneaking up to a pool though. And like when you cast a big streamer out, it's not going to be like your 6 to 8 pound female that bites. It's going to be your 20 pound male in that hole. It's going to be the big dominant fish. And he's going to just like rock it like 6 to 8 feet and crush it. Guys catch them on spoons a lot too, the exact same way. Like spoon fishing, you'll usually get like the bigger, more aggressive fish because it's just that bigger, more aggressive approach. Spinners as well. Guys will fish jigs, but like you lose a lot of tackle fishing jigs and like, it's better in like really high water sometimes because you can get down to the fish. But I preferred like if I had a hardware fisherman, like certain spoons, I had like 2 or 3 spoons I really liked. And like every guide's got different ones and depends on the weight of the spoon for the flow of the water and how high the water is, obviously. But so you'd be doing that. And depending what you're using for a fly rod, like a single hand fly rod, short sink tip, different sink tip for pretty much every run, depending how deep you got to get if you're casting and stripping versus casting and swinging. In that low water though, and if you want to, you guys that want a nymph, fairly often we'd put on like a dry fly as an indicator just to like be less spooky so you didn't have a big indicator. And like it's amazing how many fish will eat the dry fly, or like if you're using an indicator, it'll come up and eat the indicator. So it's like it's like a 15 pound male char just ate your bobber. It's like I told you, like you should be using the dry fly. And then you can, I've seen them come up and grab like mice flies as well, or like swung flies.
Oh wow.
Instead of aggression. I've hooked a few that way, never landed one. Caught lots of lake trout doing that, but hooked a few big char. But I'm not gonna lie, like I just, big fish rolls in that mouth fly, like pretty hard not to set that hook. Like Trout said, it took a lot of discipline. So like after a few days, I got the strip set down, but I generally still lost all the char that I hooked that way. But and yeah. I never did it that much, but it's just kind of a neat thing to do if I ever went out to see if you get, you know, as like when you're up there guiding, if you go fishing yourself, like I never use what works. Like it's like you try to figure something else out that you're not willing to waste somebody's time on, and other than your own. But yeah.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. It's like, hey, let's see if we can get them to bite on dry flies or like some other weird thing. And if it works, then you'll get a guest to do it. Be like, hey, this works. Like you should try this. But you don't want them to, if they have a couple days there, you don't want them to burn a day using something that's probably not going to work great, but like it might. But yeah, unless you're getting desperate. But like if they're biting something else, you don't usually do that. But yeah, my favorite way is single hand rod casting and stripping. Definitely.
Yeah.
Late season, sometimes you got to go to like a dead drift where you're like, you can still do it swinging a fly, but like kind of high sticking it out there a bit just to get that a little bit of lack of motion to get down to where the fish are and not have like drag on it. And yeah, they'll often bite pretty good like that still, but it's weather dependent too. And like you said, they're not in freshwater to feed. Some of them are, like you'll catch chrome fish that show up at the end of season.
Okay.
And like they're fresh from the ocean, and like it'll be like first cast of the day, a guy cast out and just gets smoked, and this thing jumps like four times and gets off, and it's just like, what was that? It's like, yeah. And then like two or three more happen, and then you land one, and it's like, oh, it's like a 12-pound chromer that like literally came from the ocean just now, just showing up. And those are non-spawning fish usually, and they're just showing up like to spend the winter in fresh water. But some of them I think are coming up into like that other area, because like where the fish start to spawn, you'll get like whitefish and whatnot in the area too, kind of feeding, and like it's a food source for a bunch of other fish. So like things will come up to, you know, they're eating eggs, stirring up the bottom, so you got other fish species in the area kind of chasing them. So I think some of those chrome fish show up for that reason. I think some of those lake trout show for that reason too, like the chromer lake trout that kind of come from the bottom of the river, kind of move up to that the faster stuff up top. Just like it's a lot of fish in one area that are going to be stirring stuff up and spawning, and like pretty big food source coming to that their way. So
well, do you have any large toothy mammals that show up waiting on, you know, the fish?
There are, but like there's barren grounds grizzlies there, and the one year I was there, I was lucky enough not to see any. And the other year there was too many around. It really depends on how like the other populations, like one of their big food sources there is a ground squirrel, like pretty much looks like a prairie dog. It's called a siksik. They're just like probably a 2 to 3 pound gopher, and like that's kind of like the main food source. There's muskox in the area, the odd moose, the odd caribou as well, but like not a lot of food for grizzlies. But you're right next to the coast, so like they do come up through camp, and like you try to always make sure they don't come into camp, and like they do get them to leave. But you'll see them down by the ocean fairly often, and like I have ran into a few above camp. I've never seen them actively trying to fish. Like I'm sure opportunistically they would at a few of the spots where the fish are jumping out, but
yeah,
there's enough human pressure in the area. It's usually you keep them away. Like that being said, like in the evenings or night, who knows what's going on up there, but you see tracks and like big enough piles of fresh poop that like they're in the area always. Yeah.
That's like so. One of those ones. Like I can't help but think about it like a Canadian adventure without like part of me would not want to see a bear, but then the other part of me, like on the flight home, if I didn't, would be like a little bit upset to have not seen it. So it's like,
yeah,
you know, but I don't know. I just, those char, especially the colored up ones, it's such a phenomenal looking fish. It's like a total like bucket list fish, and just like the experience as a whole. So
100%, like the place too is just like Nunavut is a, it's a vast barren wasteland of rock and water. Like it's the Canadian Arctic is incredible. Like when you fly over it, when you fly that, like you'd be going from the D's arm of Great Bear Lake where Plumber's main lodge is to the Tree River. Like you don't see a sign of a human that flight, like the entire flight. You fly like on the Coppermine River for a bit. Like you might see like a boat stashed in a lake somewhere, depending what route you take. But like, the majority of the time I've never seen anything until like on the way back, you have to stop in Kugluk Cup to fuel up and then come back down to Great Bear Lake. Usually, depending on how the flight works there, but usually you stop there to get fuel. And so it is like a settlement in the north, but like there's no roads. It's just like all the communities were pretty much every community in Nunavut, I think, except Baker's Lake is situated on the coast. Like it's just, that's the travel routes are the coast. There's the interior of that territory is, it's like exposed rock. There's very few trees. Like you're above the tree line for most of it. the southern end is below the tree line, but up there you're above the tree line. It's just, yeah, exposed rock. And like a lot of people that come to the Tree River always say like the background looks like a Western movie, because like it's kind of the same stuff as like that you'd see in like the Western United States. And having spent a little bit of time there, I've seen very similar like rock outcroppings, but like a lot of people come, it's like, oh, it looks like they could like film a Western movie with these backgrounds, but yeah. It's there's no trees or anything, like just kind of barren. The Tree River without a single tree on it, but yeah, it's kind of a different name for it. But I think it looks like a tree from the air is where the name comes from, I believe.
Okay, yeah,
I could be wrong on that, but there's some like shrubbery and willows, but like where we keep the boats above the lodge, there's like probably some 8 foot tall, like, yeah, I think they're like an alder maybe, or I'm not sure on the species, but they're definitely very old looking and probably never going to be any bigger than that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, you know,
very cool area. Like it's very hard to get to is the problem. Like to get there on your own, you would probably be paying significantly more than you'd be paying to go there as like a guided fishing trip. Mm-hmm. Like Plumbers has a pretty good system where they operate for fairly effectively, like for a fairly cheap price for how remote they are and getting there. And like the Tree River brings a lot of people, like they come up to Great Bear Lake when we want to get to the Tree River. So like a lot of people come up there and like pre-book the trip to the tree as well, like, or like exclusively to the tree. And it's, yeah, like I said, it's not like a lottery, but like you're on a waiting list for it. And then if somebody cancels or something, you might go quick, you might be able to get there sooner, but it is more expensive than just getting to Plumbers as well, because you have to get to Great Bear Lake. And then from there you fly in like a small float plane to this outpost post camp where everything is flown in on that float plane. Like the fuel for the generators, everything is all flown in like a little float plane. So it's a really unique place. Like it's cool to think about when you're there, like the people from Kugluktuk can boat there and do boat there to fish it sometimes, but you'd be looking at like a few hour boat ride from the nearest community to get to the area on like calm oceans, because you're on the ocean. Mm. So like if it's windy out, it's just a no-go. And then you get there and it's not a very big system. So I've seen a few people in the area before, like you're kind of just like your head turns, you're like, what is that boat doing here?
Yeah.
But you're pretty much the only people there, and like to get there is, it's so difficult that it's like it's not worth trying to do on your own. Like it's just, the gist of it is, it's just like going through Plumbers is pretty much the best way to do it. And it's like then you're at a camp, or you're at a camp with people that know what they're doing, and like there's no risks associated with it or anything, because like it's about as remote as you can get in the Arctic. Like you're on the coast or near the coast, so there's that, but like it is the middle of nowhere, and it is grizzly bear country too. And there's not a lot of like other food sources or anything in the area. So like when you're there, like you'd have to be bringing all your food and fuel or anything. And it's nice to come back at the end of the day from hiking for 8 to 12 hours and get back and like a hot meal. And
yeah,
there's a hot shower in camp that you can use, or if you're one or two showers in camp. So guides get it if nobody else is using it, but
yeah, that's cool.
Sparingly.
Well, I was listening to you on, like, basically while working. So it's like, you know, I'm a little distracted, but I'm listening on a previous podcast, and you know, I was just too busy to like go back and really listen in on exactly what you were talking about. So I was like, well, I'm just going to ask him on my podcast.
Yeah.
But I heard the host, if I could remember what the name of the show, I'd give the guy credit. You know what I mean? I'd shout out the other podcaster. But anyway, he'd mentioned something, y'all were talking about gear that you take to some place that you go, and you'd mentioned bringing a ladder.
What the hell is that? Oh, that was your Pyramid Lake. That's fishing what Pyramid Lake in Nevada.
So this is a legitimate ladder? You're bringing ladders to go fishing? Are you just hiking around with a ladder on your back? Like, what is ladder fishing?
Oh, so, okay, Pyramid Lake in Nevada is a weird fishery. It's a like an endorheic lake, so it's an end basin lake that the Truckee River flows into from Lake Tahoe. Okay,
Pyramid
down.
Lake in Nevada. Yeah. I remember you mentioned Pyramid Lake, and then I'm like, is that the Pyramid Lake I'm so used to hearing about? Because there's also a Pyramid Same Lake one. In Canada. So I'm like, oh, which
there
one
is? Yeah, but I've actually never been to that one, but I've been to the one in Nevada quite a few times. I think like six now, because I had a friend that was working down in Sacramento, like a roommate from grad school, actually, down in Sacramento. So I flew down there once, and then I've done the drive most of the times just so you can haul gear, like ladders, but everybody fishes off ladders there on like certain beaches. It's punishing. I hate doing it. I'd rather not stand on ladders, because I've done it for a few years. So, like that's the beach that's hot, so you do it. But like if I never have to stand on a ladder and fish again in my life, it'd be great because it's just it's punishing.
I mean, does it really give you a distinct advantage? Are you way up in the air? Like, what is it doing for you so you can see the fish?
The main reason there, at least from what I understand, like I've just traveled to do a lot, but like the locals, they're all about the ladders. It's a lot of the ridges that people fish, like the drop-offs, are maybe 150, 200 feet out into the lake where you can like wade out there. So then instead of standing in waist deep or deeper water and having waves break on you, you get up on the ladder. So you're out of the water and then it's not freezing cold. So I think it's more just to get out of the water than anything.
Okay.
There's like the advantage. You could see a bit better and cast further, but like, yeah, I've done it enough times. I've fallen off in the ladder a few times there that I, if I never have to do it again in my life, I'd be happy. So, but that's a trip I've done fairly often down there. I think I've gone almost every year since like 2017, except during the COVID years when we couldn't cross the border. Again, because I had a friend that was living down there and he's actually back in Saskatchewan now. So then we've driven down a few times there too, because like got to know some people in the area. And it's, you go in like the middle of winter when you can't really do any open water fishing here. And, you're standing on shore or on a ladder and pretty much watching an indicator float all day or casting and stripping flies, but just cool fishing for like the world's biggest cutthroat trout. And I'm it probably doesn't make too much sense, but cutthroat trout would definitely be my favorite species of fish in the world.
Okay.
Ecologically, cool. They're very unique. And the fact they evolved like on the eastern side of the Rocky Mountains and in the basin, like there's just so many unique subspecies of cutthroat trout that many of which are extirpated or extinct or locally extirpated anyway, or reintroduced. Like even the big Lahontans in Pyramid Lake were completely wiped out and were only reintroduced like 20-ish years ago. That same substrain of that subspecies, which is kind of neat. But yeah, they're just a very cool fish species. Like they're very plastic in what they've done. Not to downgrade any of their trout, but like rainbow trout generally are pretty rainbow trouty. Like there's obviously some subspeciation throughout their range, but like because cutthroats were on, there is the coastal cutthroat trout, but because they're on the interior side of the mountains on like all these like small interior basins for millions of years where they've been kind of stuck by themselves, they have adapted to each system uniquely. And in the case of like Pyramid Lake, it's like one of the largest lakes that had a lake run population of left from Lake Lahontan, so like the Lahontan cutthroat trout. So they get very large because there's like a bunch of fish species in there that you see it. Like I think the world record is like 40 pounds for them. Like it's just an insane number. In recent years, I think like guys get like probably top out. Like I've heard of like 29 to 30 pound fish, which are just like insane. The biggest I've got is like a 34 incher, which probably be like 14 pounds or something. But it's just a cool place to go and like camp down in the desert for a week and fish in wintertime. But there's definitely people that know a lot more about that fishery than I do, because I just travel down there to do it in the middle of winter. So it's probably talking to the wrong person there. It's just a unique fishery. And I love cutthroat trout. They're very unique species.
That's cool. So. Well, I can tell that like the biology of the fish and like the science behind the fish, like you really lean into that or you get interested in that. And I know that you're a fisheries biologist. So it's like, I've had a couple people on here who've kind of come from that background or are straight up in it. And I always wonder, like, maybe it's like a silly thing to ask, but like as an angler, does that, I don't know, that like mindset, benefit you like as an angler, you know what I mean? Like, have you found that like the studies that you've done and things like that have like, are they reflective in the way that you fish, or have they given you like an advantage in your fishing? Like, do you really like tie the two together?
It's hard for me to know, because like I've just always kind of had that inquisitive mind, and like straight out of high school, I went into like biology and fisheries, and like so I kind of worked in the field my entire life. Or adult life anyway. So it's, I can't answer for sure, but I would say so, because like I keep track of everything too. Like every time I fish, I write down and like what worked, weather conditions, pretty in-depth journals over the years, which I don't know, maybe lots of people do that, but I've also studied fish in lots of interesting places. Got to go to lots of cool places for like doing fisheries type research, largely within Saskatchewan. But by being there, you definitely learn more about that system. And then by, you also like kind of find out where some fish are, or like I've done some like tagging a fish and tracking them, and just you're learning more about fish. Like there's no way that hurts you, I guess, by any means.
I envision that, like, you get like insider information on like where secret hotspots are, like, oh, where like the stocking programs are, where like, oh, we've been doing some sample surveys here, and there's a big bloom of these fish coming out of nowhere in this area, and like, you know, before the other fishermen know where like this stuff is at, you know what I mean? Like
a little bit in some cases.
I'm thinking
like,
into it too much.
I definitely know some spots like that. A lot of the spots I know I found in my own time, but like that are like that. But some of it definitely through work. I'm in charge of some of the stocking in the area. So like I know where the fish are going because half the time I carry them in.
Oh, so you're cheating
in that way. But like we stock them at a very small size. But
yeah,
you stay on top of it. And like there is definitely some insider information, but it's all public knowledge too. Like so, if people call and ask, like it's part of my job to tell what's going on. So
do y'all do the stocking where they drop the trout out of the airplanes? Like you see those videos.
I'd love to say no to that, but that was definitely on my bucket list. I've never dropped from an airplane, but I've definitely dropped out of a helicopter like twice.
Okay. So now I can believe that that would be better for them. Although maybe them landing flat in the water is worse than if they hit at an angle, but like, you know, you love to see those like memes or whatever on the internet where it's like the trout fisherman's taking delicate care of the trout,
keep
them wet. And then the next image is them being dumped out of an airplane going 300 miles an hour.
Yeah, we don't have too many remote lakes that we stock trout in. Most of them are like kind of roadside ones or like fairly easily accessible just to get used. But there's one in my area, there's a remote lake that's like on a canoe route and it had been discontinued stocking for years. And like just due to public demand, we got it going again. And it definitely is, you got to fly them into the helicopter. We couldn't get helicopters last year because the all the forest fires in the area had them everything booked up. So we're actually going to try snowmobiling fishing this winter if everything pans out in April.
That's cool.
It will need like perfect conditions, so it might not happen this winter, but maybe next winter. But I've done it twice out of a helicopter, and you get like, you know, 50 feet above the water and dump it in, and you stock a few more fish thinking they're going to have high mortality. But the second time we did it, I stocked less fish like the regular amount because they didn't seem to have that high of mortality at all. They did quite well. I was shocked at, because like, you're right, like even when you're stocking fish, usually you like have a bucket full and like you measure the temperature of the water and a temperature of the lake. And it's like, oh, they're 5 degrees difference. Like mix a little bit of the water, let them sit for a half hour. Fish kind of casually swim out. And this is just like, you dump it out of a helicopter and it's like, good enough.
It's probably like a yield. It's like, oh, if we get like 20% yield out of that batch, then we're
good. So I found is like 50% or something for like helicopter survival, but like it would be so dependent on water temperature and like tons of other variables. So the first time I stocked, I had like 200% the rate that like should have got, and like it kind of stunted a bit and didn't grow as much as I liked. And then following that, the next time we did it, I did it like the regular rate because I was like, there's already some fish in it, and like they definitely seem to survive better than I had originally anticipated they would from that being dumped out of a helicopter and all. But but I've never done it from a plane. It'd be interesting to do. There is one lake in the two lakes in the province we stock via airplane, but they actually land a float plane on the water and then just like stock them regularly. And that's just because the access to those lakes is terrible. Like you can walk in or quad in, but like you don't want to quad like a bunch of live fish in through like a muskeg and like maybe spill them out. So
I just had to ask when you mentioned stalking it, because
those
videos are just, they're hilarious, and I don't ever understand how that can work. But anyway, so I have one question that I had kind of put down here. I feel like asking things like this to everybody that I have come on here. I've never really done it before, so this is sort of out of left field. Maybe it's not. But it's like, I get real interested in the mindset of the angler, or like, you know, it's like, I feel like every fisherman sort of goes through stages of what their interest and their individual pursuit is. You know what I mean? It's like some people want to catch a lot of fish. Some people want to catch the challenging fish. It doesn't have to be big, but it has to be like real savvy and very difficult to fool. And then some people just want to get the big fish, whether it's a big species or a big specimen of, you know, a species that might not necessarily be that big. But like for you, if you had to choose, like where does your interest as an angler lie? The challenging fish, the big fish, or going out and getting a lot of fish?
It's over time, it's definitely changed. I can probably map out over the years of how it changed. Where like at some point I just like catching a lot of fish, different fish, and then big fish. And in more recent years, it's more about fishing than anything, I'd say. Like, obviously, you still want to catch fish, and like trips I plan are going to be around specific things. But like, I do a lot of lake trout fishing. I'm in a good area for it, and I like really big lake trout. Like, you're just always trying to catch the biggest lake trout. So there's that. And like with pike too, it's the same way. But if I'm traveling to other places to fish, like I've done quite a bit of fishing in BC for steelhead and whatnot on the area, and you go there steelhead fishing, like it's funny to fish with other people, like you're steelheading, and it's just like I like catching everything there, and like I'll take a day off to go fish for like sea run cutthroats because like it's cool and neat. So like part of that's probably the biologist in me that just wants to see every species of fish as well, and like I will like target suckers throughout the year too, like you know, one person's garbage is another person's treasure. Like I like all fish, and that's definitely like the fisheries biologist in me that likes it that way. And part of what I do for fisheries biology is that too. It's like looking at those fish that have been neglected for years and years because they're just, they were classified even by like government agencies and places as trash fish. And it's like over time, it's like, yeah, actually they turn out to be pretty sensitive. Like a lot of quote unquote trash fish, like buffalo and whatnot, tend to be the oldest living fish there are, and like are very easy to wipe out. So there is like in southern Saskatchewan, there are big ones, buffalo. I have nothing to do with managing them. They're in a different area, but they're fairly often, they're over 100 years old. Like there's just, they've been around for 100 years.
That's mind blowing to me. That's, and that it was only kind of in sort of recent times that maybe they've known it, but it was only in recent times that that kind of information came out.
I was in grad school. So like it would have been, like that paper was published in Nature probably, it's within 10 years, I think. Like, like,
well, now they're also saying,
like mind blowing. Yeah.
They're now they've also said that the smallmouth buffalo and black buffalo is the same thing.
Yeah. So and that was like last year, 2 years ago, I read like the publication on that. So like that research would have been done like 8 to 10 years ago. And again, it's kind of the same scientists that were looking at that. They're like, that whole family of fish are like, they pretty much all live to be like older than a century, which is absolutely crazy for a freshwater teleost. Like
it really is. Yeah. I have caught one big mouth buffalo, probably to this date, one of the craziest things I've ever caught. And I mean, this thing was every bit of 60 pounds. Enormous fish. I mean, preposterously massive. Like when you look at the photos, it's like, now this was a southern fish. So I almost wonder if they aged differently than like in colder. I don't know. But, you know, when you think about, I think I saw one that it was like a 30 pound big mouth buffalo that they had like aged was like 80 or 90 years old. I'm like, it's crazy to think you're talking about a fish that's been through like the world wars and like all this stuff. And I'm like, in a relatively urban setting where I caught it.
Oh,
I'm
like,
that's nuts that this thing. And it's a really also very tragic that people look down on a fish like that. I mean, that thing's trash. So this thing's gone. They go through all these odds and come through all this crap over all the course of all this time, only to be potentially, I don't know, stomped out or culled off.
And like that just sickens me. Like even I know like up here, ice fishing people often catch like say Cisco or Burbot, like, and Cisco have no limit on them. They're just like classified as like not like a sport fish in the province where people will throw them on the ice because it's like, oh, they're eating all the eggs. It's like that's your number one bait fish in the system. Like that's a pretty important keystone species. And like with Burbot, people throw them on the ice. It's like they're actually a fairly long-lived freshwater cod that's A, delicious, B, a sport fish, and like C, very easy to extirpate in a lot of their place populations in the province. On the big ones, buffalo, you had they lived before the wars, which is actually how they aged them, because when the guy first aged them with the otoliths, no one believed that they were actually that old. And it's like, okay, they're wrong. So he tested the radionuclides because you could tell before there'd ever been an atomic bomb detonated. You could backdate it to when we first detonated atomic bombs. So that was like the Nature paper that came out. Which, as a fisheries biologist, when I read it, I was like, that's a really cool way of doing it, because my master's degree, I looked at stable isotopes, which unrelated to that, but like a similar process that went through there. So like, it's really neat to see that way. So I was like, literally the world wars are what was able to backdate it that they could tell how old that was.
Yeah.
In a lot of cases with buffalo, like in Saskatchewan, they're pretty much all like older than 80 or younger than 20 or 30. So something was done in between there with water management where they probably didn't spawn because it wasn't flooding or whatnot. But they grow for like 20 years and then they just stop growing, it seems. At least that's what I've been led to believe by some of the data I've seen. Again, I have never done any research on them or anything, but just like colleagues that have, and it's fairly interesting to see where they grow fairly quick till they reach sexual maturity and then just like don't ever grow again. But like some of them get like, I know they were calling them like sunspots. It's almost like a mole on them. Like the older ones have like a couple moles and like imperfections on them, like left colored spots. Like you could visually kind of tell like if it's really old or if it's not really old. But I think some of that's, you'd probably have to spend a lot of time looking at that to notice that. So I'm not saying I would, because I've seen a fair number of buffalo doing some other work in the area, we'll catch them in like traps and release them,
yeah,
which is always neat to see, but never anything of that size. Like probably the biggest I've seen is like that 25 to 30 pounds, but they're pretty magnificent fish. And like, you definitely have a lot of respect for them because they're I do anyway. Like that's a very long lived old fish that is, like you said, it's probably dodged a few arrows in its day. And like, they're in Saskatchewan, they're complete moratorium on keeping them at all. Like you're not even really supposed to target them fishing and immediately release them. But I think like 15, 20 years ago, like you just shoot them with bows still. I'm not sure when that regulation changed.
Yeah, it's still a big scene down here for it. As people here, a lot of people struggle to tell the difference between them and like a common carp.
That's the big issue with them.
Yeah, it's just, it's crazy to think, to wrap your mind around a fish that's been around that long. It's, you know, it's funny. I know you'd mentioned maybe starting to listen to one of the first episodes, but I urge you to listen to the episode one, this guy, Spencer Wonder, that lives down here. So speaking of old fish, so he, you know, if you listen to that one, very fascinating. That guy caught, what was it? Pacific sleeper shark?
A sleeper shark. Yeah. Like a Greenland shark or sleeper shark. Yeah.
Yeah. I think they're similar or the same. Something. Yeah, he caught
one of those. Same, just one occurs on each side of the Greenland one's like a sleeper shark from the Atlantic, I believe. Yeah.
Well, he caught one that was like 15 feet long or something like that. And, you know, we got to thinking about it and it's like, there's a fish that can live, 300 years?
I think they've aged them over 300. Like, some reason, insane. I have the idea like up to 500 in my head. Yeah, they're really,
that blows that's just the ones my aged. Mind.
Like, who knows how old some of the ones that haven't been aged are? Like, it's incredible. And saltwater fish generally, like there are quite a few that live a lot longer than freshwater ones. And then like a bony fish versus a cartilaginous one. Cartilaginous ones usually do live longer as well. But like, that's incredible. Like to think of what that fish has been through.
Yeah, we kind of joke like you're looking at holding on to a fish that's been around since George Washington was the president.
Oh, yeah. Like, again, on the trash fish insane. Thing, too, like as a shark, like they're. Sleeper sharks are generally classified as trash because they're just kind of like a dogfish. Like it's just a shame because they're just so,
that's
like,
a
so
tragedy.
Old living. And it is.
A lot of our most prehistoric fish that we have are for whatever reason considered, they're threatening. Oh, really? They had millions of years to cause whatever potential damage that you think might happen and just magically hasn't happened, but
they coexisted peacefully for millennia, and then it's like, well, we saw them eat one other fish and got all concerned. So it comes up fairly often, like in northern Saskatchewan. Like, it's funny that like people, when they catch like a lake trout, it's like, oh, it's like a 100-year-old fish. It's like there's no documented lake trout in the world that's 100 years old. Like I've seen them documented ones from like some far northern Arctic lakes, like over 70. And Great Bear, like the big ones are like the oldest they ever really live is like 50 some, maybe a little bit older than that. Like this is the sample size that's been aged. So it's going to be smaller than what's actually out there. In this area of Saskatchewan, like a 40-year-old lake trout would be very, very old. And like,
even that's respectable, like, but I mean,
it is. Yeah. And like, it takes them like 8 to 10 years to start spawning in this area or even longer in some cases. And like, we're far enough north that not every year the females will sometimes take years off between spawning. And as they get older, maybe take longer off. So you only look at so many spawning events, but it's just in lake trout or a fish like that, it's like directly correlated to how long the growing season is. So as you shorten the growing season, go further north, the fish just lives longer because it takes more energy to grow to like the same rate or size, which is kind of neat. But in the case of like the sleeper sharks, they're like living in the northern waters. They're a shark that lives pretty much forever in the like term of vertebrates. And then they are in like the deep cold waters too. And like, incredible, you can even catch them in shallow water because, like, I guess, like anything, they do come up and congregate in shallow water at some point in their lifespan. Yeah. But, like, to time that and know where they're coming up and then to do it would be pretty incredible. So,
yeah, and to catch one from land like he did was, one of the craziest things I've ever seen. I mean, the risk of failure, you know, guys with that mindset always interest me. You know what I mean? It's like, there's certain fish, like, that's too hard. Like the chance of failure is too great. So I'm not going to try it. But then there's those others who just like, well, just go try. I'm just like,
in that case, you're almost looking at like the risk of having success.
Right. Yeah.
It's obviously opposite.
You're just crazy enough to try it. Something stupid's going to happen. But man, Chance, this is an awesome conversation. I love to talk to people who are doing things that I have, you know, we're so far apart. And two just geographically completely different areas. I got sunny beaches and palm trees, and you got to dodge grizzly bears and polar bears for all I know. I don't know if
it's Saskatchewan, we just got black bears, but probably what sums it up is like the last time I was out fishing, like I just drove 70 kilometers across the lake to go fish.
Yeah, you drive across lakes. Yeah.
Yeah, that one always blows like the minds of friends of mine from in the States. It's just like, you're driving on ice? It's like, oh yeah, no, there's like 2.5 to 3 feet of ice already. So,
well, my formula for finding guests for this podcast is very simple. I see interesting, unique fish, interesting, unique anglers. So I always want to like direct people to like what I saw, you know what I mean? So like, I guess the easiest thing is always like people's social media and stuff like that. That's normally the best spot that folks have to collect their photos or to be able to reach you. I don't know. Maybe, I don't even know if maybe you're still guiding in the area. Maybe somebody wants to reach out to you or just has questions. Maybe they got fisheries questions. Where can somebody find you? Like, I don't know what all you do. I know you got your Instagram.
Probably the best bet is, probably the best bet through Instagram. And it's my handle in there is just my last name, Presti, CC Presti, CCPRESTIE. That's it. Just, first name's Chance and just initials and last name there. So it's pretty straightforward. Probably the easiest way. I might not get back to you super quick, but I will get back to you if you message me at some point. And if you have any questions about like plumbers' lodges or, but like steelheading the Skeena or anything out there, like having worked out a lodge there a bit too, obviously ask you there and I can point people in the right direction. I don't know if I'll be back at either of those this year, cause it just depending on how my work schedule works out and life here with the family going on too. Planning on it, but like, things, curveballs always get thrown up. So I never planned on stopping, and then, COVID hit and that's just kind of it was a massive headache. So, but it's definitely pointing in the direct direction, even if I won't be there. Happy to try to answer any fisheries questions or at least point you in the direction of hopefully somebody that knows better, because even a lot of what we talked about today, it's just on the peripheries of what I know. It's something I'm interested in, but it's not something I necessarily deal with at work all the time.
Yeah.
Or it's something I read 10 years ago. So I may have definitely quoted some things wrong, but I try not to go too far out on a limb there for sure. So, and I tried to post some stuff on Instagram. I've definitely fallen off it a little bit in the last couple of years. Just haven't put as much stuff out there. Sometimes trying to be more secretive about things and generally try not to put anything on there that I can like really burn any kind of a location or anything like that with.
Yeah.
Like, I've definitely made the mistake in the past and seen the results of it at times. And I fish some small systems that I don't like seeing anybody at. And so I definitely don't always do that, but I do love it. And getting to see some stuff there. I know I've, when I started following you, just some of the fish you've caught over the years, like the Gulf sturgeon, I believe, a couple years ago.
Oh yeah,
I think that was the one I saw. That I was like, I didn't know you could actually still catch those anywhere. Like, I was like, you found enough of them in a spot that you could target them.
I felt so good about that. Yeah. And I'm like, I'm the guy. I've done the impossible. And then, like, I don't know, within the last 2 years now, a few people have done it, and I'm like, well, I'm not special anymore.
It's wild. And like, I didn't realize that there was a congregation of those large enough anywhere in the world that you could theoretically even catch one. So that's kind of
What's crazy is there's so many of them that it's actually become a danger. Like, they've killed people. They're jumping and hitting boaters. It's a popular boating river. I saw it even while I was fishing out there. It's like, in fact, it got so bad I ended up having to leave because people boating like crazy, drinking beer and drunk boating. And I'm like,
I'm
seeing 9-foot fish. They're not rolling. I'm talking about full breach, six feet out of the water. I'm like, that thing hits you, you are done.
Yeah, we have lake sturgeons in Saskatchewan, and whatever it is about sturgeon, they sure like jumping into the air, because like they'll do it here too. And like, I know when you're camping in the river in some places where they congregate, you'll just all night, you can just hear it's like, sounds like somebody's dropping watermelons out of a helicopter. Just these huge blasts.
It's like explosions. And they're like razor blade sharp. I caught the white sturgeon. I caught the white sturgeon last year, or was that this year? I don't even remember. No, last year. This year. The scutes are like at least worn down on those.
Yeah,
I'm talking about the Gulf sturgeon. I grabbed hold of its tail and almost lost my hands.
Every sturgeon species, those scutes wear off at a different rate. So,
I don't know what it is, but like, it was like, I'm talking about these things
like razor blades,
cut steak. I was like, gosh. But anyway, we're getting off track here. But Chance, man, I appreciate your time. And dude.
No, awesome for sure. Stuff. Pleasure. It's a pleasure being on. Thanks for asking. So
that is an area where eventually I've got to make my way up there to try some of this stuff. It's like, we only have so much time. We only have, there's so many places to go. Yeah. Such little time to squeeze it in. But I had to pick your brains on it, because it's like, that's one that I've marked, at least on this continent, that is like top tier experience that I feel like all anglers need to try. You know what I mean? But yeah, man, I appreciate your time.
Yeah, for sure. No, thank you again for asking. So,
yep. All right, man. Have a good one.
Yeah, take care.
Thank you for listening to Boundless Pursuit. Tune in each week as we bring stories and insight from uniquely talented anglers and outdoorsmen. And if you enjoyed this show, I want to hear from you. Be sure to leave a 5-star review, as this is going to drive the growth and exposure of this show. And if you have feedback or guest suggestions, I would love to hear from you. And you can reach me at boundlesspursuitfishing@gmail.com. For all other collections of media and contact information, please visit www.boundless-pursuit.com.